1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Or I'm out of Panama. These things, it's hard to remember these things because they come and go so fast, you see. There was another incident there. Somebody insulted somebody. And we can't take that. And besides, we want to eliminate the drug trade. And if we get rid of Noriega, that will end the drug trade. And in fact, it has worked. So in the course of it, we bombard a few neighborhoods in Panama City and kill we don't know how many people. But yes, there are important questions to be asked in history. But in order to do that, you have to start with a point of view so that you will ask those questions. The idea of having a point of view is not to have preconceived answers, to be willing to be open for the answer. But the important thing about having a point of view is to ask important questions on the grounds that history is important. It's not a game of trivia. It's not a way simply to become a professional, to produce another generation of historians who will produce another generation of historians. We'll all reproduce ourselves as historians while the world passes us by and all sorts of things are going on. Of course, when you approach history that way with a point of view, it can be dangerous to your career. And people always wonder why it is that the textbooks repeat the same stories over and over again, or why history is taught the same way, or why the same set of facts are told over again, or why the same things are omitted over and over again. And the very repetition of those omissions, the very repetition of those points of view become persuasive in telling you, well, this must be the truth. If 7, 8, 10 generations of kids learned that Columbus was nothing but a marvelous adventurer and great navigator, a real professional, you know. And if everybody has been taught the same thing for 100 years, it must be true. And if you teach it in a different way, if you teach something that's been taught the same way, or if you write something that's been taught a certain way, and you deviate from that and you start to teach or to write something in a new way, well, that may be dangerous for your career. You may not even consciously think of it that way. You're not consciously selling out. It's just that in a society of economic hierarchy, in a society of economic insecurity, in a society where everybody is in some way insecure, middle class, working class, everybody's in a situation where somebody has power over them, power over their jobs, power over their tenure, power over their promotion, power over their salaries. In every such situation, there's always the thought, or even the unthought but felt need for safety. And safety results in teaching a certain kind of way, writing a certain kind of way, presenting the same set of ideas over and over again. That's safe. I guess you can put it this way. I never wanted to practice safe history. I remember when the House Un-American Activities Committee interrogated Daniel Boorstein. Do you remember the House Un-American Activities Committee? Yeah, probably some people here who were interrogated by the House. I don't want to point them out to you. But you may remember that it had hostile witnesses who refused to talk about their political activities and organizations or to name their friends. And then it had what were called friendly witnesses. One of those friendly witnesses was Daniel Boorstein, who, as you know, is a distinguished historian. I guess the word distinguished is a kind of neutral word. And he assured the committee that he, whatever radicalism he had ever had, he had left far behind. And I don't know if I have somewhere his a little piece of his testimony before the committee. He told the committee that he had proved his opposition to communism in two ways. First, by participating in religious activities at the University of Chicago. And then he said, quote, "The second form of my opposition has been to attempt to discover and explain to students in my teaching and in my writing the unique virtues of American democracy." Well, that seems objective. The unique virtues of American democracy. Now, if he had said, "I thought I would explain to my students some of the virtues of American democracy and some of the hypocrisies of American democracy," he wouldn't have been a friendly witness at that point. I suppose that I came to history with a point of view. I came to the teaching and writing of history with a point of view already, because I didn't go directly from high school to college to graduate school to teaching, because I had a number of years between high school and college. At the age of 18, I went to work in a shipyard and worked there for 3 years. I didn't do it as a sociological experiment. Go around with a tape recorder and talk to my fellow shipyard workers. How does it feel to work in a shipyard? But I came from the kind of background, the kind of family that where kids didn't go to college, where at the age of 18 you went to work so you could bring some money home, even if it was very little money home, to the family. So I worked in a shipyard for 3 years, and I think it's fair to say that I have a chapter in my this memoir that was referred to, which is called "You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train." I have a chapter in it called "Growing Up Class Conscious," and I suppose I grew up class conscious. That as I grew up aware that most people in society worked on the kind of job I worked on, that is not in a shipyard maybe, it didn't matter what they worked at, but they worked at a job that they weren't crazy about, but that they had to work at. And they might be blue-collar workers, and they might be white-collar workers, or they might be steel workers, or they might be advertising copywriters, but they still were mostly working at jobs which alienated them from the process of work and alienated them from the product of their work. And so I was aware that this kind of work existed, and I was aware that there seemed to be some people in society who didn't do that kind of work. And I very early on became aware that there was no particular relationship between how hard you worked and what were the rewards that you got as a result of this work. I never believed from, and I don't know when this started, but it's very young, I was no longer susceptible to that which you hear a lot around you, and which I remember some of my students at Boston University would express, and something that is a recurring theme in American society, and that is if you work hard enough, you will, as they say, make it. You will become prosperous and successful if you work hard. If you haven't become prosperous and successful, it must mean you haven't worked very hard. And I saw my father work very hard all his life and have very little to show for it. So my mother worked very hard and lots of people like them. And then I saw people in society who were successful and who were prosperous, And I couldn't figure out what they did. Either they didn't seem to be working very hard, or they were working very hard at producing terrible things. And they were very well paid for it. So yes, I was class conscious at an early age. The word class conscious doesn't appear a lot in American society. There's an attempt to, it's sort of an embarrassing word. Our society is not supposed to be that way. Brazil, yes. Ecuador, who knows? Saudi Arabia, there are societies with rich elites and poor masses, but not America. And you hear politicians accusing one another of appealing to class prejudices. And politicians are very careful not to be accused of that. I remember during the 1988 election campaign. Do you remember Bush and Dukakis? it's hard to remember that, something like... But it will be on the next New York Times quiz. But at one point, Bush accused Dukakis of arousing class hostility, which really surprised me. I live in Massachusetts. Dukakis was the governor of Massachusetts. And the idea that Dukakis would appeal to class hostility somehow didn't ring true to me. That he would provoke class conflict? No. That he would provoke anything? But this avoidance of class is very interesting. I read a review. You'll be getting the idea that I do nothing but read reviews. Why read books? That is the review of a movie. For that matter, why go to the movies? This was a review in the Boston Globe, my hometown newspaper, which is one of the better newspapers in the United States, which, as you know, is saying a great deal. The Boston Globe had a review of a new movie, Germinal. Some of you may recognize it. It was a novel by Emile Zola, and a novel about miners and the life of miners, a very powerful, powerful novel about the struggles of miners in their existence. And so a movie was made of it, and the reviewer didn't like it. And at the end of the review, as at the end of all the reviews in the newspaper, and I don't know if they have that here in Portland, but you know, they give the rating, G, PG-13, R. And next to that designation, they, especially if it's R, they usually say why they gave it the R designation. And usually, if it's R, they will say nudity, or partial nudity, or frontal nudity, or side nudity, or violence, scenes of violence, or profanity. And so, after the review of Germinal, it was designated R. And then it gave the explanation. And here was the explanation. This is not a paraphrase. Depiction of intense suffering and class conflict. I didn't believe it. But I'm a naive person. I see things in the newspapers, or I hear things from the mouths of politicians, and then I say, I don't believe it. which is ridiculous because that's all you should believe. I mean, what else is there to believe? You know, if I heard a politician say, you know, the history of the United States is a history of class struggle, well, then I wouldn't believe it. But in fact, this is a class society, and you could start a history of the United States with that sentence, the history of the United States is a history of class struggle. And it would be absolutely accurate. But can you imagine somebody writing, let's say, a textbook on American history for our very vulnerable students and starting off talking about our history being a history of class struggle? Can you imagine any major publisher publishing a book like that with that first sentence? Would it take very long for the publisher to go through that manuscript before rejecting it? And yet, it is an absolutely true statement. From the very beginning on the North American continent, from those first centuries of what is called the colonial period, the period before the American Revolution, we were a class society. We didn't all come here as pilgrims. I remember going to school, my impression was that those people who came from England all dressed in the same simple way. It was a very egalitarian society, and they signed the Mayflower Compact, which proved it. But no, in fact, the people who came here as black slaves, and there were other people who came here as indentured servants. Large numbers of women came as, you might say, servants and sex slaves to serve the men who were already here, the labor force that had to be satisfied in some way. Others came here with enormous grants of land given by the king or given by Parliament. And so from the beginning, they were very rich and very poor. And that pattern continued all through American history. And the poor resisted and rebelled, and there were slave rebellions, and there were servants' rebellions, and the poor of the colonies rioted, the flour riot, the bread riot, the people attack the warehouses where the flour is stored. Flour is not being made available to them because they can't afford the prices that are being charged for the flour, and they storm and they open up the warehouse and they take the flour so they can make bread and feed their families. Riots against impressment, riots because they're being impressed to fight the wars of the British in the 18th, late 17th and 18th centuries. This is all before the American Revolution. Tenants' insurrections against landlords. Crowds marching onto jails and freeing the prisoners who've been put in prison because of failure to pay their debts. And then the American Revolution comes along, and one of its functions is to suppress class conflict, as wars are very often fought with that purpose. Well, when I say purpose, it suggests a more deliberate conspiracy than I mean. But let's put it this way, that one of the consequences of wars very often, and one of the accompaniments of wars is very often the creation of a country united against a common enemy, and therefore a country which the leaders of the country hope will put aside the internal conflicts, the class conflicts, the feeling of the poor against the rich, put that aside to face the common enemy, in the case of the American Revolution, England. Didn't wholly succeed, because even during the American Revolution there were rebellions, soldiers, class conflict in the army. I mean, there's no class division more sharp and more humiliating than class divisions in the military, and where privates were not being paid and officers were being paid very lavishly. And so they mutinied, and they marched on the Continental Congress in Philadelphia and threatened it. And a number of them had to be taken out by George Washington and their fellow soldiers ordered to shoot them as a lesson to the rest. And when the revolution was over, the class conflict continued. And that, to a great degree, led to the creation of the Constitution, because the Constitution was an attempt to create a nation in which internal conflict would be controlled. And those of you who have read the Federalist Papers, or at least read Federalist Paper number 10, know that this was the argument that James Madison presented in arguing for people to ratify the Constitution, you know, when the Constitution was presented in the various states for ratification. And the argument was, you know, that there's a natural tendency for conflict. You didn't use the word class, you used the word faction. And the basis of this conflict between factions is the division of property. Some people have property and other people don't have property. And so we want to create a large republic with which will be able to control this conflict. Wasn't worried about a minority faction, as he put it. He was worried about a majority faction, which meant most of the poor people. And the way to control that is by having a big country, all 13 states together. And in that way, it'll be very hard for, and they were very blunt about this in the Federalist Papers, it'll be very hard to have a rebellion that starts in one part of the country spread very quickly to the rest of the country. It'll be contained in time before it spreads. And representation, having a representative government will be a good thing. For those of you who are intoxicated with the glories of representative government, you should keep in mind that representative government, while it's an improvement on monarchy, is also a way, as Madison put it, and Hamilton put it at another point, the Federalist Papers on the Constitution were a bipartisan effort, an early indication of how the supposedly contending groups who run American society, the Democrats and the Republicans and the Whigs and the Democrats and the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, they really are part of the same elite group with some differences. And Madison and Hamilton agreed on this, that the idea, although Hamilton was less, actually he preferred a monarchy, but he's willing to go along with representative government because, as Madison explained, if you have representatives, then if there is anger that arises in any part of the population, that anger will be filtered through the representative body. And by the time it gets through the representative body, it will have been calmed down and subdued somewhat. And as Madison put it, the reason for this, the reason for having this kind of government and this kind of constitution is to guard against things like a rage for paper money, as he put it. Because the debtors, the people who owed money at that time, wanted the state governments to issue paper money to inflation, in other words. They've scared us with the word inflation, but very often people in debt have wanted inflation so they can pay off their debts more easily. And the farmers wanted paper money, wanted inflation. A rage for paper money, Madison said, is something we want to guard against, or, as he put it, an equal division of property, or any other wicked object. So they knew what they were doing, those founding fathers. Yes, they deserve our admiration. As you know, the founding fathers were not a multicultural group. No women, no Native Americans, no blacks, and virtually no poor people. There was a 53 and a half rich white men who, as Charles Beard put it rightly, despite all the criticism he took for saying this, reflected the interests of the propertied classes. A strong central government was set up to protect the interests of the slave owners and the interests of the merchants and the interests of the bondholders. A country that would be able to move westward and protect the people who moved westward, who expanded into Indian lands. A government that would be able to send an army out into the Indian lands and get rid of the Indians and clear the way for white people to take over that land. Next time you hear somebody say, we mustn't have big government. This country was founded on the idea of big government.
You were just listening to Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, part one of a special two-part program. This classic from the AR archive was recorded at Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1995. Howard Zinn was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Noam Chomsky, Arun Gupta, Tariq Ali, Jeremy Scahill, and Abby Martin. We also have more than 45 Howard Zinn programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, Parts 1 and 2, and his great book with the same title, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and/or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building. A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be, featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go? Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from